Well, if you enjoy reading escape books, and I do, you will love the book of Exodus. It's the story of the biggest escape in history, I believe. Over 2 million slaves escaped from one of the most highly fortified nations in the entire world. It's a miracle. In fact, it was a series of miracles. So here we have this tremendous escape story. Moses actually saw more miracles than Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob put together. It is just one string of supernatural interventions on behalf of the people. Some of the miracles sound a bit like magic, as when Moses' stick turns into a snake and then back into a stick again. But most of these miracles are clear manipulations of nature. They certainly couldn't come under that blessed title of psychosomatic miracles. In these instances, God is actually manipulating what he's created for the good of his people. Now, the whole event of the Exodus had a profound significance in two regards. First of all, it had national significance for the people we call Israel. This was the beginning of their national history. This was when they got their political freedom. This is when they became a sovereign nation in their own right. And though they didn't yet have a land, they were now a people, a nation, with a name of their own, the name Israel. And forever afterwards, they have celebrated this event once a year. They hold their Passover, much as in America they celebrate July the 4th for the day of their independence. But it also has spiritual significance, and not just national significance, because this was when they discovered that their God was the God who made the whole universe, and that therefore he could control what he had made for their sake. They actually came to believe that their God was more powerful than all the gods of Egypt put together. Ultimately, they would realize that their God was the only God that existed. And Isaiah keeps emphasizing that. There is no God beside me. But at this stage, they were to discover that their God was more powerful than every other God, that he was the supreme God. It's here that he has the title El Shaddai, God Almighty. But he also has a name, and it is in the book of Exodus that the nation was given his personal name. Somehow when you know someone's name, a relationship becomes more intimate and more personal. That's why you're all wearing badges with your name on, because that helps you to begin to relate in an intimate and personal way. You can peer at the badge and say, "Hello, Peter," and somehow that helps. And God has a name as well as many, many titles. And his name is Yahweh. I don't even know if I'm saying it correctly, because I have yet to find a Jew who will tell me how to say it. They dare not even say the name in case they take it in vain. So I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it right. But the name Yahweh doesn't mean much to me. It doesn't set my heart on fire. It's a funny word. It's not English. And some time ago I was praying and I said, "Lord, please give me an English word that will convey the meaning of Yahweh to me and also give me the feelings it aroused in your people." And immediately into my mind came the name Always. I thought, that's a beautiful name, because Yahweh is a participle of the verb to be, and to call God always communicates what that name really says. And that's only his first name. He has many second names. Always my provider, always my helper, always my protector, always my healer, always, always. And so that's the name I've used for God since. But the Hebrew is Yahweh. And this was when they found his name. And he gave them not only his title, El Shaddai, God Almighty, but his name. I'm always. I'm always with you. I was always here. I'm always the same. To put it another way, it's in the book of Exodus that the creator of everything became the redeemer of a few people. And it is that combination of creator and redeemer which we need to hold very firmly. I'm afraid some Christians go to the extreme of only thinking of God as creator, and some only think of his redeeming power, but they belong together. The creator of the entire universe becomes the redeemer of a bunch of slaves. Now, this is one of five books of Moses. And when you study them, four of them are much the same, and one is quite different. Just to mention that difference first, Genesis stands alone, because Genesis is the only one of the five books of Moses that covers events before Moses lived. The other four all happened within his lifetime, and clearly he wrote the other four. But these were a bunch of slaves who'd been 400 years in slavery, without their own land, without their own money, without their own whatever. And the result was they needed to be retold their roots. I don't know if you've read Alex Haley's book, Roots. There was a man whose ancestors were sold into slavery and taken from Africa to America and became slaves. And he went back to rediscover his roots before his people were slaves. And he discovered them in Africa. It's a very thrilling story. Well, now Moses had to write the previous history of this people for these slaves so that they knew their roots, they knew where they'd come from. And so Moses clearly collected from people's memory two things: genealogies, their family trees, and stories about their ancestors. And the book of Genesis is entirely made up of such memories. And Moses collected them. But with Exodus, he begins his own lifetime. And Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are a mixture of narrative and legislation, of what happened in the history and what God said to them by way of how they should live. And it's this unique combination of narrative and legislation that characterizes the four other books of Moses. And the book of Exodus is typical. The first half of it is narrative. The second half is legislation. The first half is about what God did on their behalf by the way of miracles to get them out of slavery. But the second half is about what God said and how they were to live now that they were free. The first half, therefore, demonstrates God's grace toward them, his free favor in getting them out of their problems. And therefore the second half expects them to show their gratitude for that grace by living this way. Now the reason I've emphasized that is this. Too many people, when they read the law of Moses, think that this law was their way to be redeemed by God. No, no. They were redeemed by God first and then given the law to keep by way of gratitude. Now that's a very important point. They weren't given the law first. They were set free first. And then they were given the law to live by. And that's exactly the same in the New Testament too. We are redeemed and then we're told how to live holy lives. You don't become a Christian by living right first. You become a Christian by getting redeemed first and liberated. And then you live right. So that liberation comes before legislation. They're set free. And then they're told, now don't abuse your freedom. Use it properly. So here they are set free from Egypt, but here they enter into a covenant or a marriage with God at Sinai. And it takes the form of a wedding service. God says, I will, and then the people have to say, we will. And literally they are married, and it's called a marriage. And what follows is called a honeymoon. And then the marriage has to begin. In the land, in the place of God's choosing. They are liberated from slavery, but not so that they can do their own thing. They go into the wilderness to serve God. They are set free from slavery, but for service. That's an important point. It's the same in the New Testament for Christians. We're not set free to do our own thing. We're set free to serve God. Whom to serve is perfect freedom. So redemption comes before righteousness. That's the important point I want to make. The book of Exodus makes that absolutely clear. God redeems them first. Now he says, live right, because I've set you free. So those are the two halves of the book of Exodus. And then I've divided the rest of it up into 10 very simple portions and given them each a title, because I can memorize things that are simple, and there are 6 sections in chapters 1 to 18 and 4 in chapters 19 to 40. And running through them, the 6 sections in the first half I've called multiplication and murder. That covers the incredible increase in the number of Hebrew slaves over 400 years, from one family to 2.5 million. That's some increase. Actually, it would only need 4 children in each generation for 30 generations, and you can do it mathematically. So it wasn't all that multiplication, but they certainly became a huge number. And then, of course, the boys were murdered by the Pharaoh. We'll look at all these in detail later. Bulrushes and bush, you all know the story of how Moses was taken out of the bulrushes and therefore given the name Moshe, which means drawn out, because he was drawn out of the River Nile. The baby boys, of course, were thrown into the River Nile to the crocodiles. But Moses was drawn out of the River Nile. Plague and pestilence, well, that centers on Pharaoh and the hardness of his heart. Feast and firstborn, that's the origin of the Passover. We'll look at that in greater detail. Delivered and drowned is the crossing of the Red Sea, but they weren't drowned, but the Egyptian army was. Provided and protected talks about their journey from Egypt to Sinai and some of the things that happened, how God protected them and provided for them. In a wilderness where the Egyptian army in the Yom Kippur War was perishing after 3 days, and yet 2.5 million people survived for 40 years. Again, God had to do a lot of miracles. In the second half, we have first of all the commandments, and especially the 10 commandments. And these were sealed in a covenant, a marriage between God and his people. And God said, I will, and they said, we will. And that bound them together forever. God never goes back on a covenant. And then in chapters 25 to 31, we have the fact that God is now going to live among them. And therefore he needs a place to live. He needs a tent, but he needs a rather different tent from theirs, or they might think he's just one of them. And so we have the specification of the tabernacle, and God provides specialists, people who've never made anything but bricks up till now, and now they've got to work with gold and silver and wood. And God had to teach them those skills. And the Holy Spirit gave those skills to people who'd never made anything but bricks before. That's a miracle. And then comes the saddest part of Exodus, the story of the golden calf, when they indulged themselves and Moses had to pray most earnestly on their behalf, or they'd have never got anywhere further. And finally, the book of Exodus finishes with the construction of the tabernacle, its erection, and God takes up residence and the glory comes down on his tent. In Hebrew, this book is called These Are the Names. That's because it is read every year in the synagogue, as all the 5 books of Moses are, and it's read, of course, on a rolled-up scroll. And the first words of the scroll are, these are the names. And that's how they named all the 5 books of Moses, by the first words, so you could unroll them in the synagogue and get the right one. But when the Old Testament was translated into Greek, they gave it a different name. They used 2 Greek words, ex, which means out, and hodos, which means way. I don't know if Hoddesdon, the place down the road, is connected with that or not. But ex hodos means out way. And you would have seen it in the Greek theater, where over at that door you can see the word exit. That's a Latin word, exit. The Greek word would be ex hodos, or way out. And so this book was called The Way Out, the ex hodos. And it's just been slightly corrupted in English to Exodus. And that's why we call it Exodus. But I'm sure you realized it was the way out. It sounds too like exit. Right, well, let's look at the first half of Exodus in this talk, chapters 1 to 18. There are many so-called problems in this first half. It is so obvious an unnatural story. This kind of thing doesn't happen every Tuesday. And when you read through one thing after another, makes you wonder at times, did this really happen? And there are plenty of people to tell us it didn't, and that we're reading about legends and myths. There was a series on television not long ago which took that line. and tried to tell us that there were a whole lot of legends gathered around the beginnings of the Israelite history. Well, is it myth or miracle? Why are there these problems? Well, the first reason is that there's no secular record of these events. Outside of the Bible, there is no trace whatever of any of this in any Egyptian records, for example. Now, that is astonishing because they did keep pretty good records. And that's one of the reasons that people say, oh, this must be legend. Well, I can think of a jolly good reason why the Egyptians didn't record this. Can you? Yes, you've seen it already. I'm quite sure they didn't want to record for posterity such a humiliating experience as seeing their best chariots and charioteers drowned in the Red Sea. They didn't want to be humiliated. So I'm not troubled by the fact that there is no other record. The numbers involved create a problem for other people. 2.5 million. I mean, that's a huge number. If they marched 5 abreast, I suppose the column would be about 110 miles long and would take, what, months to pass. It is an enormous number. 2.5 million. Men, women, and children. To say nothing of all their animals. And we're told even some Egyptians came with them. That's an interesting little point. So that's a big number to get through the desert for 40 years, where there's no food or water normally. So the numbers create a problem for some. Then there's the problem of the date of it. Because we have no other record outside the Bible, we don't know, for example, which pharaoh it was. And therefore we don't know which century it was. And there are two possibilities that these scholars look at. One is the 15th century BC and the other is the 13th. If it was the 15th, it was a pharaoh called Thutmose. But if it was the 13th, and to be frank, that's the one I go for, I believe all the evidence points to the 13th century, then it would be this pharaoh, and I've got a picture of him for you, just to show you what an impressive character he was. He even had 4 statues of himself made, not content with one. He had 4. This is Ramesses II. And you can just see the top of 2 people at the bottom of the picture to show you the size of these monuments. Now, this is what the Israelites were up against. See, we often treat Pharaoh as a little baddie. He wasn't. He was a very powerful emperor. And he had the most powerful military force in the ancient world. A man who could cause those 4 statues to be erected of himself, carved out of the solid mountain. He was no mean character. But in God's sight, he was puny. And it was no problem to God to deal with that man. But I believe you're looking at the likeness of the Pharaoh who was involved in the book of Exodus. Then there is division about the route of the Exodus. And there are 3 possibilities we're going to have to look at. Again, we don't know exactly which route they took. And there are 3 alternatives to consider: north, middle, and south. And we'll have to look at those. You see, all these questions have made scholars doubt whether they're reading fact or fiction, or perhaps faction, that modern mixture of fact and fiction which we're now accustomed to with TV historical plays. Well, it does boil down to faith. And my faith says the most understandable explanation for the facts is the book of Exodus. And the facts are these. First of all, the existence of a nation called Israel. Now, nobody can dispute there is a nation called Israel in the world today. Where did they come from? How did they get started? How did they ever become a nation? If they were actually a bunch of slaves. We do know that from secular records, that they were a bunch of slaves. Something dramatic is needed to explain the existence of Israel. Or take another fact. It is a fact that every year, every Jewish family celebrates the Passover. Now that's a fact. Every Jewish family does that. Why do they do it? You've got to have some explanation for such a ritual that has survived for so many thousands of years. Well, the book of Exodus provides the most reasonable explanation of that. Well, I could go on. There are fact after fact in our modern world which have to be accepted as facts for which you've got to find an explanation. And to me, the book of Exodus gives the best explanation of all the facts. Well, now let's run through the sections of this book and look at some of the points of interest. I can't give you a commentary on the whole book. I just want to take out of each section something that might have troubled your mind or some question that you might ask and try and give you an answer to that. Let's take multiplication and murder. The question that I have is, why did they stay so long in Egypt? 400 years. They went down there in the time of Joseph and Jacob, you remember, because there was a famine and Egypt had bread. And they simply went down there because there was more food. They went voluntarily. They were accepted as guests of the government. They were given a jolly good fertile piece of the Nile Delta called Goshen. And there they were during the 7 years of famine. But at the end of that time, why didn't they go back to their own land? Why did they stay? And in fact, they stayed so long that they outstayed their welcome. And that's when they were forced into forced labor. So why did they stay? Well, there's a human answer to that and a divine answer. And I'll give you both. Because so often there are two sides to every question. The human answer is they were jolly comfortable. It was much easier to make a living in the Nile Delta than it was on the hills of Judea. Much easier. And it was fertile, the climate was warmer, there was no snow in the Nile Delta, there was in the hills of Judea. They were just altogether more comfortable, in much the same way as Lot was more comfortable down in the Jordan Valley at Sodom and Gomorrah. The climate was very similar to the Nile Delta, and it looks more comfortable. And people like to live in a more comfortable climate where life is easier. And that's why they stayed. Though God had never given them any land in Egypt, he said, I'm giving you the hills of Canaan. That's where you belong. But they stayed. Well, we can't blame them because we tend to do the same thing. And they didn't want to leave until it was too late. Amazing how many Christians find a new house before they start looking for a church or start asking how they're going to serve God there, because they've seen a house that they like. See? Well, that's what they did. And they stayed in Egypt too long until it was too late and they weren't free to leave. And they were now in the position of being forced labor. That's the human answer. And then, and only then, they cried out to God and said, God, why are you letting us be slaves in Egypt? Isn't it amazing how we get ourselves into problems? Then we start blaming God for not getting us out of them quickly. It's so human. But God didn't do anything about it for 400 years. And we've got to ask, why? Had they gone back as soon as the famine was over, there would have only been a few people. And there was room for those few in Canaan. But now they had stayed so long that they were a large people. And there was no room for them in Canaan because there were already other people living there. Now God was going to kick those people out, but not until they were so wicked that they didn't deserve to live there. And God explains in the book of Genesis even, he explained to Abraham that your descendants will stay in Egypt a long, long time until the wickedness of the Canaanites is complete. And so before God could empty the land of the Canaanites for all of them now, he had to wait until they became so bad that it would be an act of justice and judgment to throw them out of the promised land and let all the Hebrew slaves in. So God waited until he could do that. And that's the reason God gave for that 400-year gap. It's a long time to wait for God to answer your prayers. You know, you pass it down the generation. Keep asking God, and one day he'll get us out of here. What patience you need to go on praying that. 4 centuries. But God heard. And at the right time he acted. Well, now they had gone through 3 oppressive decrees. The first was forced labor. Second was to make bricks without straw. Do you realize what that meant? Have you ever lifted up 2 bricks, one made with straw and one without? The one without is about 3 times heavier. See, the more straw you put in, the lighter the brick and the easier it is to carry. But bricks without straw, that's heavy. And the Egyptians thought that if they did this, then they wouldn't have any energy left for leisure, mischief, or sex. That was the idea. And so that they'd be too tired even to make love, and therefore the numbers would go down again. In fact, the harder the conditions they made for the Hebrew slaves, the more children they had. So they had to introduce a 3rd decree, and that was that all the baby boys had to be thrown in the Nile to the crocodiles. The Nile, of course, is the source of life to Egypt. There's no life apart from the Nile in Egypt. But it was also the place of death for the Hebrew slaves. Well, now, that's the first section. The bulrushes in the bush, I don't need to say much about, except to point out that Moses, like Joseph, was brought up in court, C-O-U-R-T, and therefore was given the best education. If ever you go along the Thames Embankment in London, look for Cleopatra's Needle. There are 2 of them. One is in Rome, the other is on the Thames Embankment. And those 2 were the gateposts of the Egyptian university. And when you see Cleopatra's Needle, you're looking at something that Moses saw every day as a student. He walked past that and had a university education. This, of course, made him far better educated than any of the Hebrew slaves. And this, of course, is why he was able to write the first 5 books of the Bible. And it says he kept a careful record of everything. And he collected people's memories. And he put together these 5 books. His education as an Egyptian prince was not wasted. But of course, all that came to a sudden end when he lost his temper with one of the Egyptian slave drivers and killed him and had to flee for his life. Interesting then that he actually spent 40 years in the very wilderness where later he would have to live for 40 years with the people of Israel. So that again, God prepared him for this. I don't know if you can do this, but I can look back on my pre-Christian days and see God preparing me for what happened. I remember going in for speaking competitions in the Young Farmers Club, little dreaming that in doing that, God was getting me ready for what I do now. And God got Moses ready for leading his people through the wilderness by making him spend 40 years there by himself, being a shepherd, looking after a few goats or sheep. But then he murdered the Egyptian guard. The burning bush is very interesting, not so much for the bush as for Moses' excuses. God called Moses out of a burning bush and said, "Take your shoes off. You're on holy ground." And then he said, "Now, Moses, you're going to the people, going to be the man to draw my people out of Egypt. You were drawn out of the Nile, but you're going to draw my people out of Egypt altogether." And Moses made 5 excuses as to why he shouldn't do it. And again, you might identify with one of these. First, he said, "I am insignificant. Who am I that anybody should take notice of me?" Have you ever said that? Well, God said, "I'll be with you. Who am I?" "I'm the important one, not you." So he tried a 2nd excuse. He said, "I'm ignorant. What shall I say?" And God said, "I make you a promise. I'll tell you what to say." So he made a 3rd excuse. He said, "I'm impotent. I can't convince them. They won't believe me." And God said, "My power is going to be with you. You're going to do miracles." Then he said, "I'm incompetent. I'm not eloquent." Actually, I had a stammer. He said, I can't put words together. Did you ever say that to God? And God said, "All right, your brother Aaron will be your prophet." So that tells you what a prophet is. A prophet is simply someone who's a mouthpiece. So you tell your brother Aaron what to say, and he will say it to Pharaoh. And that's all a prophet should do. He should just pass on a message. And the last excuse he made was, I'm irrelevant. Send someone else. Here am I, send him. Again, many have answered a call from God with that. Send someone else, please, not me. And that's when God promised him a partner. Let's move on to the plague and pestilences. 10 plagues. The Nile to blood, frogs, gnats and mosquitoes, flies, cattle disease, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and the death of the firstborn. Now what do you notice about those 10 plagues? The first thing I notice is that God is in total control of the insect world. Have you ever thought about that? See, in the book of Jonah, I remember telling you that the biggest miracle there is not the whale, but the worm. I mean, God tells a worm what to do. A whale's easy. Training worms is a little harder, but God can do it. And God can tell mosquitoes and locusts what to do and where to go. He can tell frogs what to do. Tremendous sense of God's control of what is created in these plagues. But there's something else about these. First of all, do you notice their increasing intensity? There's a build-up from discomfort to disease to danger to death. The plagues gradually got worse as Pharaoh and the people refused to respond to these warnings. But I think what many Christian readers miss is that this was a religious contest. This was a contest between gods. Because every one of those plagues was an attack on a particular god worshipped by the Egyptians. And that gives the plagues a real meaning. Let me just run through some of the Egyptian gods. There was Khnum, the guardian of the Nile. Hapi, the spirit of the Nile. Osiris. And it was believed that the bloodstream of Osiris was the Nile. Then there was Heket, a frog-like god, a god of resurrection. There was Hathor, a mother goddess, was a cow. And then there were a number of sacred bulls. The god Apis was a bull. And the god Menevis was a bull, the sacred bull of Heliopolis. Then there was a god of medicine. Then there was a sky goddess, a goddess of life. Another one, Seth, was a protector of crops. And then there were 4 sun gods. And on top of all that, Pharaoh was supposed to be divine as well. So that can you see that these plagues were specifically directed against Egyptian gods? And the message was very simple. This god of the Hebrew slaves is far more powerful than all your gods. And still they didn't listen. Now there's a bit of a problem about Pharaoh's heart here that I need to mention. It says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And some, I'm afraid, have made too much of this and erected a doctrine of predestination on it, especially in the light of Romans 9, where Paul talks about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. And you can go overboard on predestination, saying it's up to God to choose whether he softens someone's hearts or hardens them. It's his choice. We don't know why he makes his choice, but he makes a choice, and he chose Pharaoh, and he said, right, I'm going to harden his heart, as if it was a bingo game. And I say that reverently, but that's the kind of God that sometimes is preached, a God who just picks names out of a hat and decides to save some and send others to hell and harden some and soften some. That's not what the Bible teaches. If you study this carefully, you'll find this. 10 times Pharaoh's heart was hardened. But the first 7, Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And after he hardened it 7 times, God says, right, if that's the course you're choosing, I'll help you to go further down that road. And 3 times God hardened it for him. Now that puts a whole different light on it to me. God only hardened Pharaoh's heart after Pharaoh had deliberately and repeatedly hardened his own heart. And indeed that's what God does by way of punishment for people. He says, if you go down this road, all right, I'll help you down this road. If that's what you really want, then I'll give you a push. And the last book in the Bible says, let him that is filthy be filthy still. In other words, if that's the route you've chosen, God will help you down that route. But there's no arbitrary choice here. Pharaoh hardens his heart first, and then God hardens it for him. I've just said that because so often the hardening of Pharaoh's heart has been misused to preach a kind of arbitrary predestination which the Bible doesn't teach. God responds to our choices. And if we persistently choose the wrong way, God will help us along that route to demonstrate his judgment if we refuse to be a demonstration of his mercy. Then we come to the Passover, the feast and the firstborn. This has a direct connection with the 10th plague. The 10th plague was that every firstborn boy in every Egyptian family must die. But that would also happen to the Jews unless they did something about it. What they had to do was to paint some blood on their doorpost. Now, blood is scarlet, maroon, which is the hardest color to see in the dark. I don't know if you knew that, but blood is the hardest thing to see in the dark. You try it sometime. But an angel would see it. And the angel of death would come to Egypt that night, and when he saw the blood on the doorpost, in the dark, no street lamps, just dark, he would pass over that house. Now, the first thing I want to say is they had to get that blood. Before they could put it on the doorpost, they had to have some. Which meant that an innocent life had to be killed to get that blood. And then it had to be applied. If they didn't put it on the doorpost, it wouldn't work. So they had to obtain the blood and then apply it. And they obtained it from what we call a lamb. But that to me is a misleading, a little cuddly white thing we think of. It's a ram. It's a 1-year-old with horns. It's a strong animal. And when we call Jesus the Lamb of God, it produces the wrong reaction. He is the Ram of God, as well as the Lion of Judah. And they had to take a ram, a fully grown ram. A 1-year-old ram is equivalent to a 30-year-old man. And that's what they took. And they killed it to get the blood and put it on the doorpost. Then they put the blood outside. They took the body inside. And they ate it after roasting it. And they ate it standing up with clothes on, ready to leave it a moment's notice. They were going to walk for the next 40 years. And they had to take emergency rations with them of unleavened bread. It's all there. And they keep that feast every year ever since. And the youngest member of the family has to say, what does all this mean? And the oldest member of the family then says, this is what God did on the night when every firstborn boy died. And we were saved because of the blood of the ram. Well, let's go on with our study of Exodus. And we've got to the fifth section of it, Delivered and Drowned. I cannot resist telling you the story about the liberal preacher. You know what a liberal preacher is? That's a man who reads his Bible with a pair of scissors. And he cuts out all the miracles. And this liberal preacher was preaching about the Exodus. And he said there was no miracle. He said, at that time and in that place, the Red Sea was only half a meter deep. And a lady in the congregation shouted out, Hallelujah! And he stopped. He said, why do you shout hallelujah? She said, the great miracle. He said, but I've explained it. It was only half a meter deep and they just waded across. He said, what miracle? She said, drowning the Egyptian army in half a meter of water. Whichever way you look at it, it was a miracle. Having said that, let's look at the practical side of it. And first of all, the question of which was the route they took out of Egypt into the land of Canaan. There are three possibilities, which you will find in various commentaries and Bible books. The first is what's called the northern route, that they left Goshen here, and they went through this row of sandbanks. These are sandbanks in a shallow part of the Mediterranean, and they crossed the sea there. The Mediterranean they crossed, says this theory, and couldn't be followed by the chariots across the sandbanks. If you look at a map of Egypt, you'll find those sandbanks marked. And this is called Lake Sabonis inside. And then went on to Kadesh Barnea. That's one theory. The second theory is that they went straight across to Kadesh Barnea. That's the middle theory. But there was a line of fortresses roughly where the Suez Canal is. The Egyptian had a very strong defense line here against any invasion from the east. And they would have had to get through that line of fortresses, which is, I think, unlikely. They weren't armed and they weren't able to fight. The third possibility, which I believe is the right one, was the southern route going down to Mount Sinai. This was where Moses had been a shepherd for 40 years. He knew this country. And it was down here that I believe he led them, and certainly Jebel Musa, as the mountain is called today, is the one in long tradition where Moses received the Ten Commandments. Sadat, the president of Egypt, wanted to build a building on top of Mount Sinai that would combine a Jewish synagogue, a Muslim mosque, and a Christian church in one building, but he was assassinated before that could happen. But all the tradition in the Middle East puts Sinai down here. But let's look at this area in greater detail, because this might explain something. The Bible doesn't say that God divided the Red Sea. What it does say is that he sent an east wind which divided the Red Sea. Now, how could an east wind divide a sea? That's the question that many have asked. Well, let's look at that area in a little more detail. The Great Bitter Lakes were actually joined up to what we call the Red Sea in the olden days, and they were joined up by a shallow sea called the Reed Sea. And in fact, the Hebrew is much more likely to be the Reed Sea than the Red Sea. Here is what we now know as the Great Bitter Lake. But in those days, it was joined up through this marshy channel called the Reed Sea. The fortified line came right down to the Bitter Lake. The Israelites left Goshen and came south because Pharaoh would only let them go into the desert, thinking he could always bring them back from there. So you can imagine them camped here, hidden by a cloud. God sent a cloud to hide them from the Egyptian army approaching from that side. Now, if this was where they were crossed, then two natural forces could have divided it. A strong east wind would drive the water of the Great Bitter Lake that way, and on an ebb tide, the water of the Red Sea would be going that way. So can you see a division coming? Rather than a Cecil B. DeMille two walls of water coming, here we have it. But of course, it doesn't explain the miracle at all. Why did the east wind just happen to come at the right time? It says God sent it. So in looking at it in a sort of down-to-earth way like this, we're not trying to explain away the miracle. At the very least, it's a miracle of coincidence. But in the Bible, there's no such thing as coincidence. There's only providence. But I believe that's what happened. And in fact, a satellite photograph of this area reveals the channel that linked up the Reed Sea is still there, but it's dry now. Can you just see it? The Great Bitter Lake, you can see the line. From a satellite photograph, you can see the old Reed Sea very clearly, whereas on the ground it's not so clear. But you can just see it joining up there. So that I believe the southern route across the Reed Sea and down to Sinai is almost certainly the right route. From there they headed north again to Kadesh Barnea. This way they avoided that fortified line on the eastern front of Egypt. To me, the striking fact about this crossing of the Red Sea or Reed Sea is the fact that it happened on the third day after the Passover lamb was killed. Their liberation came the third day after the Passover lamb died. Even more striking, and this will cause you to think, the book of Exodus tells us the very hour when the Passover lamb had to be killed. And that had to be killed in the midst of the afternoon on the day before the Passover, which is 3 p.m., the midst of the afternoon. You following me? Passover lamb dies at 3 p.m. On the third day after that, they find the escape. And they're free of Pharaoh and will never see him again. Beginning to see things. Well, we'll see more as we go on. Let's now move on to the next section. I have to go back to the original. Provided and protected. They are now in a place where there is no support for human life, except a few Bedouin. It is certainly not a place to take 2.5 million people, plus animals. There would be both external problems and internal problems which Moses had to face. The external one was food and water. Where do you get enough food and water? The answer is God had to provide it. And he provided food for them in the form of little round pieces of whatever lying on the desert floor every morning. And when they harvested it, they found it was edible. They gave it a name. They called it, what is it? In Hebrew, manna. But it means, what is it? What's for breakfast, Mummy? What is it? What are we having for lunch? What is it? What for supper? What is it? Not again. And they lived on what is it for 40 years. We call it manna as if that's a beautiful name, but that's all it means. But they then complained. It was literally bread from heaven. That's picked up again later in the Bible. But they lived on bread from heaven. They complained bitterly that they weren't getting any meat. They were used to a high-protein diet in Egypt, and they complained they weren't getting enough meat. Always tricky to complain to God. He sent such a flock of quails that they were lying 1.5 meters deep on the desert floor. And they ate quails until they were sick. Don't complain to God. He might give you what you want. What about water? Well, they had a real problem with water. The first oasis they came to was this place. That's a photograph of a place called Mara. And they saw water there, and they dashed to it and tried to drink it. And it was brackish and salty. It was undrinkable. But through a miracle, through Moses, it was cleansed, and they were able to drink it. But you can almost see the brackish state of the water there. That's taken at the very place. However, the next place they got to, there was fresh water, and this is a photograph of a place called Elim. And so God provided. When the water was bad, God improved it. And when it was all right, well, they didn't have a miracle, they just had water. So God provided for them and protected them. Do you realize they needed 2 million gallons a day for that number of animals and people? 2 million gallons per day. Later they would get it from rock reservoirs. To me, one of the biggest miracles of their providential journey was that their shoes never wore out. I've been in sandals climbing Mount Sinai, and it wrecked the sandals. The sharp stones of the desert of Sinai wreck shoes quickly. And it says their shoes never wore out. Now, you either have to say this is true and God did it, or you have to dismiss it all as legend. There's no in-between stage when you read statements like this. But they also had internal problems. Can you imagine that number of people camping together? I mean, sometimes it's bad enough just taking your family camping when you're all pushed together in the same tent or the same caravan. Can you imagine 2 million people? It's no wonder that one of the biggest problems Moses had was actual disputes between the people. And he had to be a judge. And they all came to Moses with their problems, like in some large churches, everybody wants to go to the pastor with their problem. That's what was happening. And fortunately, Moses' father-in-law was a good deal more sensible than Moses, though he was not one of God's people. And he said, you need elders. And Moses appointed 70 elders. Well, let's go back and on with the sections. We're into the second half now. And the first thing that happens in the second half are the Ten Commandments, written with God's finger on the rock, on two tablets of stone. Now, every time you see a picture of those two tablets of stone, you see the first four commandments on one and the next six on the other. It wasn't like that at all. 10 were on one and 10 were on the other. Why? Because this was a legal contract. And one copy was God's and one copy was the people's. You understand now why it was two tablets of stone? Because that's how it should be done. There should be two copies, one for each party. But since it was a covenant as well as a contract, God wrote them both. There was no bargaining went on. God said, now this is how you're to live. And he gave them three legal collections. One we call the Ten Commandments, or the Decalogue, which means 10 words. The second we call the Book of the Covenant, which we find in chapters 20 to 23. And then we have another book of laws in chapters 25 to 31 or 32, which are laws of worship. Now, all these make up the law of Moses and more. There are more in Deuteronomy as well. But the law is not just 10 commandments. It's a whole lot more. There are 613 rules and regulations for the way that to live right before God. But let's start with the 10 commandments. There are three basic principles, or two, that I want to mention. First of all, the principle of respect. All the 10 commandments are based on that principle. Respect for God, respect for his name, respect for his day, and then respect for people, respect for family life, honor your father and mother, respect for life itself, don't murder, respect for marriage, don't commit adultery, respect for people's property, don't steal, respect for people's reputation, don't bear false witness, respect, respect, respect. A healthy, holy society is built on respect. And a nationally known television comedian recently said, we intend to leave nothing sacred. And TV comedy, more than anything else, is destroying respect. Respect for the Queen, respect for authority, respect for the police, respect for the law. We can see in our society what happens when respect disappears. But God's law is based on respect. Loving God and loving your neighbor can be translated respecting God and respecting your neighbor. That's the basic principle behind God's law. It's a law of respect. And loss of respect for God leads you to idolatry. And loss of respect for people leads you into immorality and injustice. So that you can see how the law is made up. It's a good law. Most of the Ten Commandments are about acts and deeds or words. But the last of the ten is about feelings. It's the only one about the heart. And perhaps that's why Paul once said that he kept all nine, but he couldn't manage the tenth. And the tenth one is don't be greedy. Don't want what you haven't got. That's the only one concerned with your inner life. The rest are all concerned with behavior. There's a principle about the ten laws which the Jewish boys and girls learn on their fingers. And the principle is this. If you break one, you've broken them all. Because they belong together like a necklace. And you ladies, doesn't matter where you break a necklace, but if you break it just once, the beads are all lost. And this is a profound principle. They're not 10 separate commandments. They are the law. They're not laws. They're the law. And if you break it at any point, you've broken the law. If a policeman stops me for speeding, it's no use my saying, but I've stopped at every red traffic light this afternoon. So it doesn't matter how many laws you've kept, you've broken the law. And God says this is a whole law, a holistic law, we would say today. You break one, you've broken the lot. It's spoiled. It's in pieces if you break it at any point. Respect, you see, is a whole thing. And you can't have some respect and not others. You either are a respecting person or you're not. And you show you're not when you break one. The second principle is responsibility. And now we are brought up, I'm afraid, on psychology and sociology to believe that people are not responsible for their actions. They're even now trying to say that wickedness is due to a gene. Well, we know that original sin goes down through the genes. But the idea that some people are more wicked than others because they have a wrong gene means they're not responsible for what they do. The law of God says you are accountable, you are responsible, you have chosen to break this. And it holds us responsible before God, every one of us, to live right before God. So the two principles of respect and responsibility are written in. And therefore, a third principle is also written in, the principle of retribution. There are sanctions in this law. One of them is capital punishment. The death penalty is applied to 18 different sins against God in the law of Moses. Aren't you glad you don't live under the law of Moses? Because breaking the Sabbath, death penalty. There is retribution here. There is punishment. And I notice particularly there's a very careful distinction in God's law between intentional and accidental breaking. There are two sorts of killing. There's intentional murder and there's accidental manslaughter. But in every case it says there is no sacrifice in the Mosaic law for continued deliberate intentional sin. And there isn't in the New Testament either. You read the letter to the Hebrews. Well, now this law is given in a context, and the context is this: I brought you out of Egypt, I'm going to bring you into Canaan. This is how you're to live now. Now that's an important point. It's on the basis of what God has done for them and what he will do for them that he appeals to them to live right now. And it's the same in the New Testament, isn't it? It's on the basis of what God has done for you and what he's going to do for you that he says, now this is how I want you to live now. Without that context, the law becomes a harsh, impersonal, horrid thing. But in that context, it's a good thing. It fits. It's the response of gratitude to God's grace. Then we come to the fact that God wants to live with them. He gave the Ten Commandments at the top of Mount Sinai. Oh, let's look at Mount Sinai, perhaps. It's a fearsome mountain, and there's another picture on here that you'll know what I'm going to talk about in a moment. Forget this for the minute. There's Mount Sinai. It's an extraordinary mountain. I've climbed up it at 3 o'clock in the morning before the sun came up. I found a little girl at the top, a little Jewish girl, reading the Ten Commandments in Hebrew. And I said to her, what's your name? She said, Miriam. And I said, my, you've been here a long time. But anyway, St. Catherine's Monastery is at the foot of it. But I always wondered, when it said in the Bible, don't touch my holy mountain. I thought, how can you touch a mountain? It's ridiculous. Until I saw this picture. You can actually walk up to the mountain and touch it because it rises sheer from the desert floor. Can you see that? It's like a cliff. And they had to put a fence around it because God wanted them to realize he was a holy God. And anybody couldn't just come up and talk to God because he's holy. And therefore he said, nobody must touch my holy mountain. So Moses sensibly erected a fence around the bottom because you could just walk up to it. There are some people there and you could just walk up and touch the mountain. But God was going to communicate to them his utter holiness. He said, Moses can come up, Aaron can come up, but none of you must even touch my mountain. But now God says, having given Moses the Ten Commandments up here in the middle of lightning and thunder and fire, awesome sight, God says, I want to come down and live in the camp with you. But if I do, it must be a tent that communicates my holiness. A tent that you must treat respectably, that you must treat with awe. A holy place. In fact, right in the middle of the tent will be the room where I actually live, and that will be the Holy of Holies. And so God gave them specifications for his tent. You had a glimpse of it earlier, but let's look at it again. It had to be right in the middle of the camp, and all the other tents had to be arranged around it in a special order, which we'll come to later. And immediately around it were the priests and the Levites, so that they were between the ordinary people and the holy place. And the tent itself had to be fenced off with only one entrance. And then God's tent was inside, but that had two rooms, and the inner room was God's room. And into that, only once a year, one man could go. Nobody else, ever. And the whole tent is just full of detail. Let's look at some quick pictures of it. The beauty of it must be breathtaking, yet most of the beauty was hidden. Beautifully embroidered curtains and coverings, and yet they were all covered with a badger skin outer thing that would hide the beauty from the people. All they would see would be this rough outer skin, only knowing that inside were golden pieces of furniture and beautiful curtains embroidered with heavenly colors. There was blue, the color of heaven. There was red, the color of blood. Silver and gold. It was a magnificent tent with this high fence around it that you couldn't see over, so that in a sense it was hidden. There was a mystery attached to it. And here you see some of the priests at the outer veil. Then there was another inner veil before the Holy of Holies. Well, let's go inside and sort of see inside. Here you have the outer room, the kind of vestibule, the anteroom of God's palace, if you like. And here there were the table of the showbread, the seven-branch candlestick, another little altar. In fact, let's go back to the other one. You see, if you wanted, even the priests approaching God had to come to an altar first and offer a sacrifice, kill an animal and burn it. Then they moved on to a great big basin to wash themselves clean. The whole thing is saying, if you're going to come to God, you'll have to have a sacrifice first, and then you'll need to be clean. It's full of meaning, this, isn't it? In fact, God said, this is a copy of Where I Live in Heaven. This is just a replica of the real thing. So there's the anteroom, and finally in the Holy of Holies, one piece of furniture of shittim wood covered with gold. The mercy seat. The cherubs. Inside some manna. They never saw it. Even when this tent was dismantled and moved somewhere else, this was covered up. And the tent had to be carried by special people. And the ordinary people had to keep 1,000 paces away from it until it was erected again. The first thing, erect God's temple, tent, then you could put your own up at the proper place around it. It all spoke of God's holiness, and yet it also spoke of a holy God who was willing to live in the midst of his people. Amazing. We have perhaps lost something of the awe and the reverence that is needed with a holy God. We've got too pally with him. We need to remember he's holy. The high priest, even the clothes of the priest were specified. They had to be right. And the high priest wore on his chest the 12 jewels which represented the 12 tribes whom he was a priest for. And those 12 jewels crop up again in the last page of the Bible in the New Jerusalem. Well, we could spend hours on this, but you'll have to read other books. It's full of meaning, full of symbolism. God says only special people can use this, priests, and only special people can build it. And that's when he gave them these incredible skills. You'd have thought all that would really bring home to the people God's utter holiness. But while Moses was up the mountain, you know what happened. Aaron stayed down this time. And the people came to Aaron and said, Moses is a long time up there. I don't think he's coming back. We want a God down here. And so Aaron said, give me your gold. And they gave gold. And Aaron told Moses later, I put it all in a melting pot and out came this. I mean, if you're going to have an excuse, you can think of a better one than that. But that's what he had the bare face to say to Moses. I just put the gold in and look what came out. Now, of course, that photograph is of an Egyptian god. I told you about the bulls and the calves, a symbol of fertility. And the bull is a very common symbol. I'm told there's a golden bull like that outside the European Stock Exchange in Frankfurt on Main. It's a symbol of wealth and fertility, prosperity. And this came out, said Aaron. And because idolatry leads to immorality, because the loss of respect for God leads to the loss of respect for people, they had a wild orgy. Well, you know the story. It's a sordid bit. And when Moses came down and saw what was going on, he broke both copies of the law and smashed them. He was only symbolizing what they were doing. They'd smashed it already. And he said, how could you do this? And then he went back up the mountain. He said, God, I'm fed up with them. And God said, so am I. And God said, I think I'm going to finish with them. I think I'll try someone else. And that's when Moses reached the height of his career, I think. He took the form of a priest then and he said, God, if you're going to blot them out of your book, blot me out. I don't want to be the only one. And God replied, I only blot out of my book the names of those who sin against me. And you haven't. And that thought is taken up all through the rest of the Bible. When David sinned with Bathsheba, he said, God, don't blot my name out of your book, please. And in the last book of the Bible, Jesus promises, he who overcomes, I will not blot out his name from my book. The most important thing in life is to keep your name in the book of life, believe me. God says, I blot out of my book those who sin against me. It's a tragic story. And when Moses insisted that the people were punished, do you know how many died? 3,000. Now, I want you to bear in mind that the law was given on Sinai on the 50th day after the Passover lamb was killed. Just let me put this together for you. The Passover lamb is killed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. On the third day after that, they are liberated. On the 50th day after that, the day they called Pentecost, they were given the law and 3,000 people died through breaking it. Now, does that put something together for you? Isn't it amazing? The pattern of the old and the new. The letter kills, but the spirit gives life. On that same 50th day, centuries later, when the Jews were celebrating the giving of the law, God gave his spirit and 3,000 people get saved. See? Same 50th day. How the Bible fits together. Finally, the last section in Exodus, construction and consecration. They build it. Where did they get all the material? The gold, for example, 1 ton of gold was used. Well, it says that every man gave a fifth of an ounce, or 6 grams of gold each. Where did they get it from? The answer is the Egyptians were so glad to see the back of them that they just gave them all their jewelry to get rid of them. Take it and go. After the 10 plagues, the ordinary people just wanted the Jews to leave and they gave them all the money and the jewelry that they could give them to bribe them. So that's where they got it. But it says that for the construction of the tabernacle, the people gave spontaneously, thoughtfully, regularly, and generously. Now there's a sermon for somebody here as a preacher. It says they gave spontaneously. They didn't have to be wheedled or pressed into giving. They gladly gave. They gave thoughtfully. They thought about how much it should be. It wasn't just the top coin in their purse. They gave regularly. They went on giving. And they gave generously. And it says they had to be stopped. giving. Isn't that lovely? Boy, if only the Lord's people always gave like that, you'd have to stop them giving. Hallelujah. And finally, God takes up residence and consecrates the tent. And they saw the glory come. And from then on, they saw the plume of smoke. I don't know if that was on that other picture. But from then on, they saw the pillar of smoke above that inner room. Now, the inner room had no natural light whatever. Not even candles. But it was ablaze with light. The glory of the Lord. And when they saw that move, they had to move. And when it stopped, they camped. Well now, I've got just under 10 minutes left in this talk. What's the Christian use of the book of Exodus? Well, it's the same God. He hasn't changed. The God of Exodus is our God and we are his people. He has not changed. And he deals with us in the same way as he did with them. That's why many of the words in Exodus are used again in the New Testament. Words like law, covenant, blood, lamb, Passover, Exodus, leaven. All these words in the New Testament get their meaning from the book of Exodus. So we need to know this book. And yet, it's different. We are not under the law of Moses. We are under the law of Christ. That's very, very important. Otherwise, I'm breaking the law of Moses now because he said you mustn't wear clothes of mixed material. It must be pure wool or pure cotton. I'm breaking the law of Moses. But I'm not under the law of Moses. I'm under the law of Christ. Now, in many ways, that's harder. And in other ways, it's easier. But the first way that Christians apply the book of Exodus is to apply it to Christ. And see Christ in this book. Search the scriptures, he said, for they bear witness of me. Now, the Exodus is central to the Old Testament. All the books after Exodus look back to Exodus as the redemption on which everything else is based. The cross is central to the New Testament. In what way is the Exodus connected to the cross? Well, 6 months before he died on the cross, Jesus was on top of Mount Hermon, that snow-capped mountain at the north of Israel, 4,000 feet high. And he talked with Moses. And Luke's gospel tells us what they talked about. I wonder if you've ever noticed what they talked about. It says they talked about the Exodus which Jesus was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Isn't that amazing? Moses and Jesus talking about the Exodus that Jesus was going to accomplish. That gives us a clue. Jesus, of course, died at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at the very minute when thousands of Passover lambs were being slaughtered. That's why Paul says, Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. It's all there. So the angel of death can pass over. He rose from the dead on the third day after it. And it's his resurrection that liberates us from death. He is the bread from heaven. New Testament says he is the rock from which Moses drew the water for the children of Israel. John in his gospel says the word became flesh and tabernacled among us. What an interesting word to use. Literally, and pitched his tent among us. For the tabernacle to us is Jesus. God dwelling in the midst of people. So we understand Christ much better now. And he said, I didn't come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. So we apply the book of Exodus not only to Christ, but to Christians. For example, crossing the Red Sea prefigures baptism. Paul says, the children of Israel were baptized into Moses in the Red Sea. And you've been baptized into Christ. What crossing the Red Sea was for them, your baptism is for you. Did you ever see that link? Amazing link. We too have a Passover meal regularly. For the Lord's Supper is simply a Passover. I went to a synagogue in northeast London, northwest London, Finchley, and I was the honored guest and sat next to the rabbi for the Passover meal. Wonderful privilege. And he took bread and he broke it, gave thanks for it and gave it to the people. And then he took a cup of wine and he gave thanks and he passed it to the people. And then he happened to look at me and he said, "This is not communion." He saw on my face what I was doing, what it meant to me. Because this was my Passover meal. See, I was remembering the setting free, the liberation of Christ. And Paul says, "Rise and keep the festival, but not with the leaven of malice and wickedness." There's an equivalent of unleavened bread in the Christian life. Leaven in the New Testament is usually a picture of malice and evil and bad thinking. And there's a festival we have to keep without the leaven. But we also have a law to keep. In many ways, the law of Christ is much harder than the law of Moses. The law of Moses says, don't kill anybody. Well, I haven't done that to my knowledge. Have you ever wished anybody dead, says Jesus? Law of Moses says, don't commit adultery. Well, I haven't done that, but the law of Christ says, have you ever thought about it? Much harder to keep the law of Christ than the law of Moses. I'd rather try and keep the law of Moses any day, wouldn't you? And yet it's much easier. Because we don't need a lot of priests and a lot of ritual and a lot of special buildings. As one dear Scottish lady said, when I want to enter the Holy of Holies, I just throw my apron over my head. We enter right into the Holy of Holies. Whenever you pray, you can enter the holiest place of all, unhindered, in the name of Jesus. There's a big difference then between the new covenant and the old. Under the law given at Pentecost, 3,000 die. Under the Spirit given at Pentecost, 3,000 live. I'd rather have the Spirit than the law. And the Spirit writes the law inside. But there is still a future deliverance for Christians equivalent to the Exodus. If you read the book of Revelation, you'll find the plagues of Pharaoh are going to happen all over again. There is an astonishing correlation between the plagues at the end of history and the plagues of Pharaoh. And those who remain faithful to Jesus will come through all that and be victorious. And you know what the book of Revelation says? That the martyrs and those who have overcome all the pressures of persecution outside and temptation inside, they will sing the song of Moses. In heaven you'll hear the song of Moses. And if you go back to Exodus in chapter 15, the first song recorded in the Bible is a song composed by Miriam to celebrate the drowning of the Egyptians in the Red Sea. And when all these worlds, this world's troubles are over and we are safe in glory, we can then sing the song of Moses. We shall have had a double exodus, both the exodus of the cross, which has happened already, and the escape from all the trouble that's coming through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.